It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Governor Walker's trip to London got some headlines because of some questions on foreign policy and evolution. Our guest looks at the foreign field trip as part of a presidential candidate's audition process.
First, Governor Walker's administration has shared new information about the proposed $300 million cut to the UW system in the next budget.
The governor's office said it would consider speeding up the transition of the UW system into a public authority and that the system would be free to decide how to split the cuts over the next 2 years.
Walker himself told reporters during his trip to London that he would consider putting a permanent cap on UW tuition after 2017, restricted to the rate of inflation. Here with us now to talk about these updates is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel higher education reporter Karen Herzog. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, one of the things that is being floated now by the governor or his aides is the possibility of the university splitting up the cuts in any way they want over 2 years. What do we know about how that could work?
Well, the interesting thing about that suggestion is it was news to the UW system. They have been planning all along that if they do face a $300 million cut, it would be in equal amounts. And the biggest challenge with that is coming up with these cuts so quickly, considering that the next fiscal year begins July 1st. So that's $150 million you have to come up with in cuts in the first year. And, of course, campuses are also looking at it on their level as well. So it's possible that it could help if they could take a smaller cut the first year, giving them more time to figure out how to handle the next cut, and also at the same time having additional flexibilities that the governor is proposing, assuming the legislature does agree with that.
Has there been reaction from the university on the possibility of splitting up these cuts in a way that's not half and half over 2 years?
Well, hard to say if that's something that that will happen. That was something that was just discussed in the past day, and I'm told that perhaps it could help, but again, it all kind of depends on how this shakes out in the legislature, and what the extent of the cuts are, and whether a public authority is granted along with those cuts to help manage the cuts.
And another idea that's been floated by the governor's office now is to the possibility of being granted that flexibility that the UW has been after earlier. Some use the word immediately so that they could start putting some money-saving tactics into effect right away. What do we know about that so far?
Well, that could be a challenge. Setting up a public authority, if it really does become a public authority, would take some time. It's a huge transformation in how they currently do business, and that's why I believe they originally said July 1st, 2016. Now, there are obviously some things that if the state decided, or the legislature and the governor decided that the university wouldn't be held to certain things, rules regarding like capital projects or procurement, things like that, they could start making some of those changes now. But the UW system has been clear that they don't believe that any of these flexibilities in the short term would make up for a significant budget cut.
And how about the news that we're hearing now about Governor Walker being open to freezing tuition beyond 2017?
Well, the interesting thing about that proposal is that several legislators have indicated that they're uncomfortable with giving the UW system authority over setting tuition rates in the future. The fear being that if the UW has the ability to do so, it would raise tuition significantly to make up for the cuts that it's had to take in the past, you know, in those previous years. So if the governor is able to get it through as a cap of tuition increases at the rate of inflation, that would probably smooth the way for legislators to give up perhaps more of the authority to the UW system. Now, whether it's truly authority over tuition, if you instill a cap at the rate of inflation for the future, I don't know what that does to the public authorities' flexibilities.
And one of the big concerns expressed by lawmakers and the public about the cuts and public authority designation taking place at the same time is that the university might need to raise that tuition and eventually price out some in-state families. Is this move, this idea that's being floated now, do you think intended to allay some of those concerns?
It is, and I think there's some balance here that the thinking is that if you freeze the tuition for in-state or keep that in balance, There is still non-resident tuition and also tuition for the professional schools. Now, especially at Madison, there's a lot of conversation about how other schools within the Big Ten are so much more expensive, and that essentially, you know, some people would argue that that they're underpriced in Madison, and that there is room to make up some of that money by increasing non-resident and professional school tuition. And in fact, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank has asked that be done as quickly as possible, if that is going to be considered.
Are there any more specifics to that plan that we know right now?
You know, it's all up in the air, and it seems like it changes every day. You know, the possibility that some of the cash balances that were so controversial starting in the last couple of years, that those cash balances could be used to fill part of the cut if that cut does happen, that's kind of a new part of the discussion in the last couple of days. So it's really hard to tell how this is going to change as the legislature picks it up and debates it. As we've said before, this is just the governor's proposal. It's the first step in the process for setting the budget.
And keeping in mind that it's just a proposal, do you have any ideas about how a freeze like that could potentially impact the university system and its ability to raise revenue?
Well, other than, actually, tuition is one of the major revenue streams for universities. And in the past, when there have been state funding cuts, the universities have been able to increase their tuition. So when you cut the budget significantly and also freeze their ability to raise that revenue stream, it is a challenge. And I think that any of the chancellors would tell you that in the past they've somewhat been able to deal with cuts because they had that flexibility. Going forward, if they don't, they're looking at program cuts, possible layoffs, things like that. They say that there just isn't really, there isn't an easy solution to this.
The Walker administration has also brought up the issue of the university's cash reserves, saying the system could cover the cuts through these reserves. What do we know about how much money there is in them?
Well, the amount of money as of December 31st was about $1.3 billion. And that's about $146 million less than a year ago. Now, as you may recall, 2 years ago when there was such an uproar at the Capitol over these cash balances because they weren't fully disclosed by the UW system, there was a lot of talk about how they should be spent down. And the UW system is very careful to say that this isn't one big pot of money. This isn't $1.3 billion sitting in a bank account. It's money that's spread across the campuses. So it's not money that you can just capture $300 million out of just like that. So I do think it's possible that some of that money will be used to offset cuts, but how much I just don't know at this point.
Now, looking back at this option we discussed earlier about the university being able to decide what portion of the cuts of the $300 million proposed cut that they would take each year, so if they had the option to decide to do it in uneven segments, how could that potentially benefit the university?
Well, I think it would be potentially just buy them time to figure out how they want to, where they can find the money. If they need to cut programs, it gives them time to think about that. Because if you think about where they are, the budget's not really going to be decided until probably June, middle of June, late June. And universities have to set their course schedules, their teaching loads, all of those things have to be set within the next couple of months before those decisions are made on the budget. So if they could take a smaller cut the first year, that would give them more time to plan for a larger cut the following year.
Is your sense so far that the prospect of being able to do that takes care of some of the concern of the university, or is there still a lot here that there's concern over?
Anybody saying in within the universities that no matter how the cut is divided, that it would be easy to handle. And this is just so new, I haven't had a chance to talk with too many people about how much it would help to divide the cut differently. Other than, as I said, I do think it gives them more time if they wanted to take a smaller amount of it the first year, that it would give them more time to find efficiencies, to maybe do some consolidating between campuses, sharing of programs. All of those ideas have been floated. In addition to that, UW System President Ray Cross has hired a consultant to look at back office savings, potentially consolidating or regionalizing some of the functions such as human resources and IT and payroll, and basically taking advantage of technology to perhaps save some money.
Is it fair to say that the governor has felt some significant pushback on the issue of this proposed $300 million cut to the UW system since he proposed it in his budget last week.
Absolutely. In fact, the chancellors, interestingly, have waged social media campaigns. Just in the last couple of days, I know that UWM Chancellor Mark Mone has sent out email blasts to 52,000 people, students, faculty, or excuse me, parents, alums, all asking them to contact elected officials and to express their opinion about whether these cuts should happen. So I believe there's been a lot of pushback in not just the campuses, but also from the community.
Now, the chancellor, Chancellor Blank, held a late-night meeting last night, reportedly, so that she could speak with third-shift workers. Is the action that is being taking place at the university right now, does it seem unusual to you?
That's hard to say. Obviously, these are presented as unprecedented cuts, and I think there is a sense that if they go through, there's a good chance that there would have to be layoffs, and obviously that's something that would be have to be carefully decided. And I think there is a huge emphasis on communications. The chancellors aren't just making decisions in their offices with their inner circles. There is a lot of discussion on all of the campuses, really trying to be inclusive, because shared governance is a part of the UW system, allowing all the faculty, students, staff all have a voice in what happens in the university. Ultimately, it's the chancellor's decisions on what's going to be cut, but they are definitely taking input from everyone who's involved.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Karen Herzog, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Governor Walker's administration has proposed some modifications to his budget proposals for the UW system. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear one family story of volunteer tourism at an animal sanctuary in Costa Rica and an orphanage in India.
First, Governor Walker's trip to London this week might not have gotten the headlines he was looking for. His public appearance at a foreign policy think tank included several questions on foreign policy, which he declined to answer, and one on evolution, which he said he was punting on as well.
Walker isn't the first potential presidential candidate to have difficulties in London, so why do people in that position make the trip and take the risk? Charles Franklin helps us answer that question today. He's director of the Marquette Law School poll and a longtime political analyst here in Wisconsin. Charles Franklin, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back.
So why does a presidential candidate or would-be presidential candidate go on these foreign trips? What are they trying to establish in the minds of voters?
Primarily that they've been to other places. They have some experience in those places, though, you know, a few days in a foreign country doesn't really make for deep experience. But this is a nearly universal ritual for candidates who haven't been involved in international affairs. Senators have a little bit of an advantage there because they can travel on congressional business. But governors in particular need to travel around to establish that they've been to Europe, been to England, been to Israel, wherever. And that's a little bit more of a stretch for governors. It's part of the job for senators, which gives the senators a little of an edge.
Yeah, and it seems like for a governor with the experience that they can point to, you know, the executive stuff, the domestic issues, in a way they're playing to their weakness, the thing they have the least to do with when they go to another country.
I think that's true, and the idea that the trip makes up for that weakness is perhaps a bit of a stretch. On the other hand, you can certainly look back and look at recent presidents, and you know, Bill Clinton didn't have a huge amount of foreign experience. The second president, Bush, pointed to his experience dealing with Mexico as governor of Texas, which was a bit of a stretch. Whereas, in contrast, the first president, Bush, had incredibly deep foreign experience as an ambassador and as a CIA director. President Nixon, of course, was very much known for his foreign experience and interest. So we've had a lot of variety in presidents. Some come to the office with almost no foreign experience. Some come with immense foreign experience.
Is this something that voters worry about, or maybe it varies from election to election?
It depends in part on what the issues of the election are. You know, In this election coming up in 2016, you have to wonder, will we still be focused on domestic issues, or will foreign issues, perhaps ISIS or terrorism or other things, become a dominant issue? And it's very hard to know that ahead of time because these issues can change pretty quickly.
It seems like this trip to London has been a stumbling block for different presidential candidates. I think Mitt Romney got in a little trouble criticizing London's preparedness for an Olympic Games. The headlines that have come out of Chris Christie weren't great. Governor Walker, with his evolution thing, is getting attention not for the things he wanted to get attention for. Is it worth it, given that a lot of the headlines that seem to come back are negative or at least off message?
I think there has been some of that, and actually Governor Jindal just in the last month or two also had some statements in England that he probably wished he hadn't made. It certainly illustrates the difficulty of going and making it a success. Governor Walker had adopted a very low-key approach on this trade mission, and it was only in this extended question and answer session yesterday that he got pushed on some issues. I think here we're focusing a little more on the evolution comment, but that was at the end, after he had declined to answer four or five or maybe six questions about foreign policy, including a question about, well, who are your foreign policy advisors? Who do you look to for guidance on foreign policy? And I think all of those cumulatively reflected that a trip to England doesn't make you ready to talk about foreign policy. Now, again, this is not unique to Governor Walker. It's something that every governor, at least, has to deal with, and for that matter, senators do. But I would expect now, in the return from there, that these questions start coming up in press conferences and press availabilities quite a bit, and they will be part of the normal vetting process for the next year and a half, at least, as we collectively go through the process of picking a nominee and then eventually picking a president.
Now, Governor Walker alluded to a concept, I'll misquote the principle, but the idea that partisan politics end at the nation's borders, where as a, say, a governor, you shouldn't be in another country criticizing the sitting president of either party. Is that a tradition that a lot of politicians observe, or is that just maybe a golden age sort of concept?
I think it's more of a golden age and, certainly not universally accepted by any means. It is brought up from time to time. I think you do need to consider the context. He was speaking at one of Britain's most revered centers for international relations. And so to speak at an international relations think tank is to invite questions about international relations. And even on trade issues, the conversation did not go very deep beyond talking about, Wisconsin cheese and how good it is and how we should all buy it.
A message we could probably at least all agree on, regardless of partisan affiliation.
Here we can agree on that, for sure.
Well, through primary season and maybe into a general election, what historically have governors running for president been able to do to burnish their foreign policy credentials?
Well, some of it has been the relatively trivial, go and be photographed with a foreign leader. That's hardly unusual in this process. But I think the most critical thing is simply to be able to talk coherently about your foreign policy views. And that's something that's not going to happen in a single meeting. It's something that's going to develop over the next 12-plus months as we have candidate forums, as we have encounters with the press, both in press conferences and on television interview shows, and especially as we get to candidates talking to each other in either forums or debates, where they have to present and defend their ideas in the face of opponents who will have their own take on these things. I think those are the places where we'll really start to see who has developed some real views on foreign policy and is able to articulate them in a convincing way.
Well, the next arena, all eyes are on Iowa, especially for Governor Walker, because he's more or less on home field there or close to. Is this sort of thing, the headlines that came back from London, of any relevance at all to your average Iowa Republican caucus goer?
Well, I think for the most part, these are not top-of-the-head issues. One of the long-running questions is, when it comes right down to it, how much do foreign policy matters really play in voters' minds as opposed to things that are much closer to home? But I think in the broader context of saying, is this the kind of guy I want to see as president, each of the candidates has to establish that comfort level among voters. It's important to realize that within both parties, most of the candidates are pretty acceptable to most of the voters within that party. And then the question becomes, okay, of the half dozen or even dozen candidates that I as a voter would find acceptable, which ones of these really seem to me to have what it takes? And that's where being able to talk about a wide range of issues, domestic as well as foreign, really becomes important and is a longer-term effort.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
That was Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll, talking about Governor Walker's trip to London.
Coming up, one family story of seeing the world while volunteering. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. One of the biggest travel trends around these days is volunteer tourism or voluntourism. Instead of staying in a comfy hotel, spending your day sightseeing, you connect with organizations that need help and do things like tutor orphans, build schools, and farm.
Our next guest and his whole family decided to take up the challenge of volunteer tourism. They spent 6 months abroad and volunteered in Costa Rica, Thailand, New Zealand, and India.
John Marshall joins us now. He wrote about his journey in the book Wide Open World, How Volunteering Around the Globe Changed One Family's Life Forever. John, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica and Rob, thank you so much for having me.
Well, how did you first get that idea for a year of service or volunteer tourism?
Well, the idea, I mean, like a lot of families, I think, we always had a fantasy that we would take a trip around the world. The problem was we just couldn't afford it. And so our children were getting older and older. And finally, when our son became a junior in high school, we thought, you know, this is it. If we don't take this trip and actually make this happen, it's never going to happen. Because once he gets to college, you know, that'll be the window will be shut. But then I had this idea. It actually just popped into my head. I wasn't thinking of anything at the time. And the idea was year of service, those three words. And as soon as those three words occurred to me, I knew exactly what they meant. And I knew if I said them out loud, it would actually happen, and that's what happened. I told my wife, and she chomped down on it like a pit bull, and we took off.
Well, the idea, you know, appealed to you for a bunch of reasons. As you say, a big one was that you wanted to reconnect with your family, your kids, and your wife. Why did you think that volunteering abroad would help that cause?
Well, we did some traveling before when our children were 7 and 5. We lived for a year over in a Portuguese fishing village after a few tragedies in our lives, and that really brought the family close together. We really needed to depend on each other. We lived in a very small place, and I thought if we could take this trip, which would fulfill a lifelong dream, it would also make us depend on each other. You know, like a lot of families too, I think our children were kind of lost in cyberspace. They spent all their time on their phones and their computers, and I missed them. I wanted them back with me, and I thought, well, if we can just unplug them, we'll get them back in the family. And and so that's what we did, and you know that actually proved to work.
And before we get to the trip itself, I know a lot of people listening might be going, well, how do you actually pull that off, even volunteering, when you've got a home, you've got a mortgage and bills and all the stuff that costs money and needs our attention every day? How did you go about planning kind of the financial end of it?
Right. I mean, that's one thing that I want to stress to people who are listening is that if we can do this trip, you could, if you wanted to, you could do this trip. I mean, we ended up doing it for 6 months We couldn't quite pull all the details together, so we ended up taking our year of service and kind of squashing it down to 6 months. But 6 months is still a nice long time. And we ended up renting our house. We did have to leave our jobs. That was something we had to do. We took the kids out of school, and we took out a home equity loan. So, I mean, we didn't have a pile of cash to where we could say, you know, let's just go squander this on our big trip. But our budget was really low. Our budget was $1,000 a month for all four of us to live and eat in a foreign country. And that works out to $8 a day per person.
Hmm.
So that was much cheaper for us to travel around the world for 6 months than to stay at home and just live in our lives. And in the book, I have a section at the back that says how to volunteer your way around the world. And it will walk you through all of our expenses, exactly how we did it, how we pulled it together, and lay it out so that anyone who really has a desire, not just, you know, a passing thought like, oh, wouldn't that be nice? But if you make the decision to go and do it, I really think that's the key. Once you decide, then the rest is kind of details to figure out.
And typically when you do one of these volunteer stints, does the group that you're you're volunteering with, the organization, did they pay for your place to stay, your room, your board, that kind of thing?
No. You know, volunteering is a way that a lot of NGOs make some money. So to have a volunteer come to you, it takes some resources from the organization. So they need to give you something to do, but they need to supervise you, and they need to make sure, you know, and communicate with you. And so they charge a small fee for the opportunity to go and serve. Some places don't. Some places are completely free. If you go and volunteer on organic farms, say in New Zealand, as we did, it's free. You just find an organic farm that needs some help, and you go and live with them, and they give you free room and board in exchange for your service. But like when we taught English in Thailand, there's an organization in America called Voluntai that takes non-English teachers and puts them in rural parts of Thailand to help out, places that typically wouldn't get teachers to go because there's no sites to see. And there it cost us $900 for all four of us to go for a month and live and work in Thailand. So you just have to do some searching around and find places that fit your budget. But there's free places out there, and there are places that cost a little bit. There's places that cost a lot, but you just find what works for you.
Now, the first place that you chose was Costa Rica, and you admit that you kind of chose it because you thought it would be easy, kind of easy on your kids, too. Take us to those first days when you were meeting these, for instance, troop of spider monkeys that you were going to be part of.
Right. I mean, the funny thing about Costa Rica was that I did pick it because I thought, okay, this will be an easy way to kind of wade into the shallow end of the service pool. I mean, what are we going to do at a sanctuary? We're going to rake a few cages. Maybe we're going to, you know, feed the animals. It'll be easy. It turned out not to be that way at all. The place that we went to is the only place that I know of that's raising orphaned or injured spider monkeys outside of cages. So when you go there, you actually live in a cage, and the monkeys are on the bars outside your windows. Then every time you step outside, you're just part of the monkey troop. And so the monkeys will climb right up on you. Now, the only problem with that is I got a note right before we got there that said that the monkeys sometimes don't like large white males. And that's a pretty good definition of me.
And you wonder what don't like means.
They love my wife. But they kind of wanted to keep me in my place, I think.
So did you have any close encounters with angry spider monkeys?
Yeah, no, it wasn't anger. And the answer to that question, though, is absolutely yes. You'll see in the book if anyone looks at it. There was one monkey who I think really liked me. Everywhere I went on the property, this monkey, whose name was Sweetie, would climb on me and ride me everywhere I went. I would sit on my head and sit on my shoulders. But the problem was she was very jealous of other people and other monkeys. So monkeys look very human. They look like little humans. They look very smart when you're up close with them, but they're not. I mean, they have different rules. Things like dominance and territory are things that their lives revolve around. So when someone shows too much attention to you, one monkey can get jealous, and instead of going after that other monkey, they go after me, which made for some pretty harrowing and sometimes funny encounters with these guys. But I love my time at the sanctuary, even though I have a few scars to remember it by.
So you're at the Osa Wildlife Sanctuary. This is your first stop on this round-the-world trip of volunteering. Did you feel at that point like, you know, this is going pretty well? The family and I are coming together. Sure, we had a rough, you know, really awful bus ride out, but this is shaping up to be what we want it to be, or was it challenging right away?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a fairy tale. This wasn't like we hit the road and suddenly the angels started singing and the skies parted. You know, there was definitely difficult moments. I mean, spider monkey bites aside, there was homesickness, and there were internet withdrawals, and there were times where, you know, our kids, maybe other parents can relate to this, but around the house here at home, they're not always so eager to work. And if I take them out in the yard and want to rake up the leaves in the fall, you know, if you get 5 minutes of work out of them or 10 minutes of work, sometimes it's like pulling teeth. But out on the road, that's the job. Like, you're there to work. And so as teenagers, my daughter was 14 and my son was 17 at the time, you got to work. That's part of the deal. So in Costa Rica, we got absolutely royally chewed out by the person who was running the place. And he said, look, this isn't a vacation. You know, you're here to work. And it really struck my kids, I think, because they the next day came on time for the first time ever. They did their jobs without complaint. And from there on after, they just did the work that was required of them. Like in New Zealand was our next stop, and we worked on the farms. Sometimes we'd have to work for 5 hours a day. And there I am with my son, who hadn't chopped wood for more than 5 minutes in his whole lifetime. He's spending 5 hours with me chopping log after log with no complaint, just working hard and kind of actually getting into it. And I can say for myself, and I imagine other parents out there can imagine this too, when I watched my kids working willingly, that was like my highlight of this whole trip, watching them work and do what was asked of them and be really capable. I mean, these kids taught their own English classes in Thailand. My two kids had their own classes that they taught by themselves. And that only is not good. I mean, that's not only good for your resume, but it's good for your soul. It's good for you as a person.
We're talking right now with John Marshall. He's a writer, producer, and director. He's the author of the book Wide Open World, How Volunteering Around the Globe Changed One Family's Life Forever.
And we'd like to hear what you have to say. Have you spent time volunteering in other countries? What was your experience like? Do you have a story to share? What do you think about the big rise in this idea of volunteer travel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about volunteer travel this hour. Another word for it is voluntourism. It's what our guest and his family did for 6 months in a wildlife sanctuary in Costa Rica, an orphanage in India, a farm in New Zealand, and more. John Marshall joins us now. He's the author of Wide Open World.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Have you been a volunteer tourist, a voluntourist? Call in, share your experience at 800-642-1234.
And we've got one of WPR's staffers in the studio with us, Elizabeth Deliquis, who has clocked some time doing volunteer tourism around the globe recently. You've been in Ireland, you've been in Morocco. Elizabeth, thanks for stopping by.
Always good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about where you went.
Okay, so I was traveling for 7.5 months, and I volunteered with an organization called Workaway. And Workaway is nice because you sign up, you do you pay like $30 for a 2-year membership, and then you can just find hosts, you contact them, you arrange what kind of work you're going to do, when you're going to arrive, you work out all the details, and then you go volunteer with them. So I spent 3 months in Croatia, 3 weeks teaching English in Morocco, 3 weeks building houses in Spain, 2 weeks working at a guest house in Norway, and 2.5 weeks doing yard work in Ireland.
And all of those, what was the most rewarding to you, the one you remember the most?
Croatia was the best because I was there the longest, and I think the longer you do a volunteer placement, the more you get to know people, you become friends with your host, you get to know the local area, you start to pick up the language, so you really feel like you've become part of a community in a way that you don't if you're doing a shorter placement.
And you agree with John, our guest, that there was something sort of good for the soul about working so hard and doing it to help people.
Absolutely. I think when you're doing more conventional traveling, it's kind of like... It's kind of like you're a consumer, you know, you're going around and you're seeing sights and you're going to restaurants and you're not really becoming a part of the community. Whereas when you're working and living with a local, you're having an experience that you would never get in a guidebook anywhere.
Great. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
That was Elizabeth Deliquist, a staffer here at Wisconsin Public Radio who has spent some time volunteering abroad. And we're going to go to our callers next. Ellen, you're with us first in La Crosse. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I traveled for my second time in January to St. Lucia with a group out of Wausau, Wisconsin that's called the Good News Project. They've had a presence in the Caribbean, St. Lucia, Grenada, and St. Vincent, or St. Lucia, Dominica, and St. Vincent for about 30 years. We don't travel for 6 months or 8 months, but you can get a sampling, and you go for 2 weeks, and we build houses. We build small 16 by 12 houses that are much better than what the people had prior to our arrival. We do some visits at the nursing homes and some of the schools and the prison, and it is a fantastic experience.
Well, thank you, Ellen. I appreciate you sharing your experience building small houses. And John, it sounds like people are saying it is quite a cultural immersion going on there and something that feels good. Do you feel like you did move through quite a few countries? Do you feel like you really got to know them, though, along the way?
Yeah. Well, like Elizabeth said, I think the longer you stay in a place, the more you're going to have an impact. And that's not just an impact that you'll have, but the impact that it will have on you. Our plan was to stay for 1 month in each spot, roughly 1 month in each spot. And by doing that, then you actually get to know a place instead of just breezing in and out and having a tiny bit of impact. But like your caller said, I mean, so she goes for a week or 2 weeks. That's great. I don't want to give the impression that, hey, unless you can go for 6 months, it's not worth doing. Because I think that even a vacation can be enhanced by a day. Find a place where you can be of service for a day. And, you know, the attitude of this is not to go in and think, I'm going to change the world. I mean, we didn't feel that in our trip, like we're going to go out and be so benevolent and save the world. Because in the end of the day, what we found was that it's the world that changes you. And so, but you have to go out and be open and be humble and show up and do your best. And, you know, we found that the rewards you'll get, and that's probably a familiar refrain for most anyone who would comment on having done this, is that you'll get so much more out of the process than you put into it.
And one of the things you did was you worked with orphans in India at a place called The Farm. And the man who ran this particular orphanage, you asked him what he wanted you to do when he said, you just love the kids. So what did you do to carry that out?
Right. I mean, The Farm is something that I'm still to this day involved with. It had a really profound impact on me because, you know, you think of orphans. Everyone thinks of orphans as kind of a sad, faceless mass that's out there in the world. There's an estimation, that there's 150 million orphans in the world today. And so, you know, what do we do about this number? It's so massive, we just forget about it and move on to something else. But when you meet them one at a time, when you meet these kids, when you see someone who's hopeless, and you help to bring them into a place where they now have hope and love and food and someone who cares for them, that is really the best work that I've ever been a part of. And I've done some fun things. I mean, I've worked in television. I've done some fun jobs. But helping these children and being a part of their lives, they treated me, some of these kids at the farm, I'm not sure why, but they're so filled with a joy that's really palpable that they were filling me up every day with love as if I was the one who was empty. And I'm there to help them. So really, working with those kids was really, I mean, I did everything I could to make them happy and to add some value, and we did fundraisers, and I shot videos, and I did whatever I could to help them. But in the end of the day, I got much, much more from them, I think, than I could have ever given to them.
Let's take another caller now. Laura joins us in Madison. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi, what is your comment?
I was just calling. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Western Samoa in the South Pacific for 2 years. And I had a really great experience, and I thought it was interesting. A lot of the callers are talking about the personal experiences, which I could talk for hours about. But on the other side of it, what we were doing there, the Peace Corps did a great job of instilling the idea of sustainability and that our projects were meant to be sustainable once we were gone. I worked specifically with a little boy who had a hearing disability, and it wasn't just, you know, getting him a hearing aid. It was teaching him sign language, teaching his family sign language, teaching his classmates how to communicate with him with his hands. So once I was gone, that could continue, and he can continue learning and progressing throughout school once we were not there anymore.
Laura, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that. And John, as we run short of time here, was there a moment on this trip that you knew you were changed forever, your relationship with your family, but also who you were as people?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about, I felt before in my life that you imagine the world, you have a sense that it'd be nice to do something, to have a life that has some meaning, to have some purpose, to be of service, to do something like this. And you may imagine the world is a certain way. Well, going out and taking this trip, for me, was a way, you know, I've had a moment where I was struck by this, that if you want to fall in love with the world, you need to meet it first. And when you meet it, it's really easy to fall in love with people that you meet. You know, it's like orphans. You might think of orphans in a hypothetical sort of way, and it's hard to really feel what it would be like to help one. But when you meet these kids, or when you meet the families that you're staying with, or the children at the Thai school, or all the different places where we went, when you meet them, when you actually get to spend time, then it's really easy to fall in love with them. It's really easy to
want. Leave it there. To meet the world, to fall in love with the world, you have to meet it. John Marshall joins us now. He's the author of Wide Open World.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. We'll check in on the latest budget reactions and follow up on the governor's trip to London.
Actor and Princess Bride star Carrie Elwes joins us to tell stories from behind the scenes of the classic movie.
And on Food Friday, Valentine's Day desserts.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.